This episode of Food Psych is brought to you by my upcoming book, The Wellness Trap. Break free from diet culture, disinformation, and dubious diagnoses, and find your true well-being, which is available for pre-order now. Just go to ChristyHarrison.com/thewellnesstrap to learn more and pre-order it for its release later this month. That's ChristyHarrison.com/thewellnesstrap. Welcome to Food Psych, a podcast dedicated to critiquing diet and wellness culture and answering your questions about intuitive eating and the anti-diet approach. I'm your host, Christy Harrison, and I'm a registered dietitian, certified intuitive eating counselor, journalist, and author of the books Anti-Diet, which is available now, and The Wellness Trap, which will be out on April 25th. And by the way, on this show, I avoid saying diet culture stuff like weight and calorie numbers, but we don't censor swear words or other adult language, so listener discretion is advised. Hey there, welcome to this episode of Food Psych. I'm your host, Christy Harrison, and today I'm going to be answering an audience question about the new diet drugs that are getting all kinds of media coverage and being hailed as quote-unquote miracles, and why we should all be extremely wary of them. Before I get into it, a few quick announcements. This episode is brought to you by my online course, Intuitive Eating Fundamentals. If you're ready to make peace with food and get support in navigating this ever more toxic diet culture, I'd love to have you join the course. You can learn more and sign up at ChristyHarrison.com/course. That's ChristyHarrison.com/course. This episode is also brought to you by my upcoming book, The Wellness Trap, Break Free from Diet Culture, Disinformation, and Dubious Diagnoses, and Find Your True Well-Being, which is available for pre-order now. The book explores the connections between diet and wellness culture, how the wellness space became a hotbed of scams, misinformation, and conspiracy theories, why many popular integrative and functional and alternative medicine diagnoses are misleading and harmful, and what we can do instead to create a society that promotes true well-being. Just go to ChristyHarrison.com/thewellnesstrap to learn more and pre-order the book for its April 25th release. That's ChristyHarrison.com/thewellnesstrap. And once you've pre-ordered, you can get a special bonus Q&A with me about the book by uploading your proof of purchase at ChristyHarrison.com/bookbonus. Now, without any further ado, let's get into this week's question. A quick content note that we will be discussing the names of diet drugs as well as the drug class they're in, since it's all kind of unavoidable in this situation. The question is from Anne, who asked me to weigh in on GLP-1 agonists, which are the trendy new class of injectable weight loss drugs that you've been hearing so much about. So thanks to Anne for that great question. And before I answer, I'll just give my standard disclaimer that these answers and this podcast in general are for informational and educational purposes only, aren't a substitute for individual medical or mental health advice, and don't constitute a provider-patient relationship. Also, this is just my take as one dietitian and journalist, and I encourage you to seek out other perspectives and consult your own inner compass as well. So I first wrote about these drugs 2 years ago, back when one of them was approved by the FDA, but I've been meaning to revisit the topic now that there's so much more in the public discourse, largely because celebrities are taking them and influencers are touting them, which has created shortages among people who use them for their original use of managing diabetes. So your question comes at a good time. The short answer to your question is that I'm still very much not a fan of these drugs and wouldn't recommend them. I think they're problematic for many reasons and that we're likely to see safety concerns emerge with them over the next few years as more and more people start taking them, as has unfortunately happened with a number of quote-unquote miracle diet drugs in the past. So first, for anyone who doesn't know, GLP-1 agonists are a class of diet drugs that were originally developed to treat diabetes, but are now being prescribed, in many cases off-label, for weight loss, which is a side effect of these drugs. Two of the most popular members of this drug class are semaglutide, sold under the brand names Ozempic and Wegovy by Novo Nordisk, and tirzepatide, sold as Mounjaro by Eli Lilly. The drugs are typically administered as weekly injections and may have intense side effects and potential safety concerns, as we'll discuss shortly. But they've been hailed as quote-unquote miracles because they can lead some people, though not all, very much not all people, to experience significant weight loss that can be maintained for as long as they keep taking the drugs, though generally people regain weight pretty quickly once they stop. In fact, a minority of people don't lose any weight on these drugs at all, and others will lose some weight, but then they quote-unquote plateau far above their goal weight, remaining at the high end of the BMI spectrum and feeling compelled still to keep losing weight. And so in some cases, that can push people to start adding other drugs, combinations that may increase safety risks and bring many more side effects, and that really haven't been studied, but that are being encouraged by some doctors because, you know, once somebody kind of opens the seal on weight loss drugs, it's sort of tempting, I think, in some cases to add more weight loss drugs to the mix and kind of keep pushing and pushing for greater amounts of weight loss. At this point, I just want to pause and say that I do not judge or blame anyone at a higher weight for taking these drugs, because the pressure to shrink your body and diet culture is all too real, as we've discussed for many years on this podcast. You know, it's completely understandable why larger bodied people, really as well as anyone who perceives themselves as quote unquote too fat, would be drawn to these drugs. The promise of being able to escape weight stigma and meet our culture's ridiculous body standards is incredibly seductive. Yet these drugs are marketed in a way that preys on people's vulnerabilities, and they're not the miracles they're made out to be. In fact, for some people, they can be quite the opposite. To maintain weight loss, people need to stay on these drugs long term, no matter the side effects, but those can be brutal. The most common ones include nausea and vomiting, as well as stomach cramps, diarrhea, bloating, gas, and other gastrointestinal issues, which researchers and journalists who look favorably on these drugs tend to downplay, but which can profoundly reduce the quality of life for the people taking them. Even in the absence of these GI symptoms, one study found that more than 17% of patients taking this class of drug developed masses of undigested or partially digested food in their GI tracts, putting them at risk for gastrointestinal obstructions. And that's really serious. What's more, the long-term safety of these drugs isn't known, but there's definitely reason for concern. Rare but serious side effects documented in clinical trials include pancreatitis, gallbladder disease, and kidney damage. As these drugs become more widespread, more people are likely to develop these issues, which already has been the case with gallbladder disease, with higher risks for people taking these drugs for weight loss than those who are taking them for diabetes, and higher risks for those taking them long-term as opposed to short-term. And that's really important to keep in mind when, you know, you see the marketing and the push from these drug companies and doctors affiliated with them saying, well, you know, you really need to be on these drugs long term, right? And that, you know, higher weight is a disease, a lifelong disease that needs to be managed through medication, right? Which is just such a weight stigmatizing and frustrating argument. And in studies of rodents given clinically relevant doses of semaglutide and tirzepatide, the drugs have been shown to cause thyroid tumors, which was concerning enough that the FDA issued a boxed warning, also known as a black box warning, on the drug's labels. Now, studies in rodents, of course, don't necessarily translate to outcomes in humans, as I'm always talking about here. So we can't say for sure that the same risk would even apply to humans taking the drug. But the FDA does not take the decision to put a black box warning label on a drug lightly. These are the most serious type of warning that the FDA can issue. And fen-phen, that notorious diet drug that was recalled in 1997 for causing heart valve damage, didn't even have a boxed warning thanks to industry lobbying. Belviq, another weight loss drug that was pulled from the market in 2020 because of cancer risks, didn't have one either. And so given the boxed warning on these new diet drugs, it seems that the safety profile of this drug class, GLP-1 agonists, is already more concerning to the FDA than those recalled diet pills in the past. And that should definitely give you pause if you're thinking about taking these drugs. If the trajectory of GLP-1 agonists is anything like previous diet drugs, some of these rare but serious side effects may eventually be enough to get these drugs pulled from the market. Now, of course, the American Academy of Pediatrics, or AAP, is recommending that pediatricians give these and other diet drugs to kids, which is a horrible idea for all the reasons I just outlined, plus many others that people like Virginia Sol Smith and Reagan Chastain have articulated, and I'll link to their pieces about this in the show notes. I haven't personally had a chance to write my own piece about the AAP guidelines, and I really don't know that I have much to say beyond what these folks and others have said. The AAP guidelines are a disaster, riddled with conflicts of interest, including the fact that many of the guidelines authors took money from Novo Nordisk, which is also a patron of the AAP that donated between $25,000 and $49,999 to the organization, as Reagan reported. A few weeks ago, I was listening to a podcast interview with a journalist who'd written a glowing review of these new diet drugs, as many journalists, unfortunately, have done. The interviewer asked if she had any financial ties to the pharmaceutical companies that make these drugs, and she said no. And the moment felt like it was supposed to be significant, but I couldn't help but laugh a little because, of course, a journalist isn't likely to have any entanglement with the pharmaceutical industry, right? But nearly all the researchers she cites in her article have consulted for Novo Nordisk, the maker of semaglutide, which is, of course, a conflict of interest. Among the two researchers quoted who don't have any documented relationships with pharma companies, one is the head of research at Weight Watchers. So these conflicts are very real, and they show up in so much of the reporting about these new diet drugs, especially semaglutide, over the last couple of years, as I detailed in that piece I wrote in 2021, where already a journalist in the New York Times was quoting pretty much all sources that had ties to Novo Nordisk and didn't disclose all of them. And sometimes in the framing of these conflicts of interest, journalists will say, well, you know, all researchers on quote-unquote obesity do some consulting or have some relationships with pharmaceutical companies, right? Like as though the whole field, that's just how it is. And when you have expertise in this area, you're just going to be asked to do things for pharma companies and it's totally kind of no big deal, right? That's how it's being framed. And I just want to say, like, it is a huge deal. I think it affects the way that these researchers and clinicians view these drugs and prescribe these drugs and talk to the press about these drugs, downplaying the side effects, not even mentioning the black box warning from the FDA, right? I've seen almost no media coverage reporting on that. So that's really concerning. And I think it's really important to take these conflicts of interest into account. And also, I think it's really damning of the entire quote-unquote obesity research industry that we see so many of these conflicts of interest, that we see so many quote-unquote experts in the field are, you know, deeply financially tied with pharmaceutical companies that make diet drugs. And even among those who aren't, many of them, as I just mentioned, are deeply financially tied to the diet industry, right? The head of research at Weight Watchers, for example. And many of these, many researchers, prominent researchers in that field do have financial ties to diet companies as well as, or instead of, pharmaceutical companies. And that can also include, you know, running their own weight loss center, or bariatric surgery center, or something like that. So I think it's really important to keep that in mind when you read glowing news reports about these drugs, right? And if you can, try taking the long view. Because diets and diet drugs come and go, they have for decades, and they all tend to get framed as quote-unquote miracles at first. But the long-term outcomes are almost always far less rosy. One last thing I just want to mention is that these new diet drugs are sometimes getting framed, and I think this is happening especially at the sort of hand of the researchers who have ties to the pharmaceutical companies. They're getting framed as solutions to weight stigma, right? They're getting framed as something that's going to destigmatize higher weight because it's showing, oh, it's actually a biological issue. You know, once people's appetites are dealt with, their body size shrinks, and therefore we shouldn't be demonizing people for, you know, not losing weight and saying that it's, you know, a personal responsibility issue or something like that. It's actually, quote unquote, a disease is their argument, right? And I think that's super problematic for a number of reasons. Number one, you know, medicalizing higher weight and framing it as a disease and telling people they need to shrink their bodies is in and of itself weight stigmatizing. And we've seen that in research. I've talked about that in the podcast in the past that, you know, that is in and of itself stigmatizing and shaming to people to think about their bodies as diseased. Another piece of it is, you know, just a really interesting historical context that I'd invite you to keep in mind, which is these drugs, you know, diet drugs have been around for decades, like I said, and so many of them have been pulled from the market because of side effects and problems that they've been shown to cause. And, you know, at no point in there was the stigma on weight reduced, right? At no point was it sort of framed as, okay, now we know that this is a medical issue or this is a disease. And so, you know, people need help and people need pharmaceuticals and medication to address it. So society is going to have to, you know, shift its views around weight. We've never seen that happen with other diet drugs, and I don't think we're ever going to see that happen with these ones, despite the rhetoric that's being used by these researchers who have pharmaceutical company entanglements and the journalists who uncritically report on them. So I hope that's helpful in starting to unpack some of the issues with these drugs, Anne, and thank you again so much for your great question. To submit your own question for a chance to have it answered either here or in my Food Psych Weekly newsletter or potentially both, you can go to christyharrison.com/questions. So that's our show. I want to thank you so much for listening. And if you're looking for help healing your own relationship with food and breaking free from diet and wellness culture, I'd invite you to check out my online course, Intuitive Eating Fundamentals. You can learn more and sign up at christyharrison.com/course. That's christyharrison.com/course. This episode was brought to you by my upcoming book, The Wellness Trap: Break Free from Diet Culture, Disinformation, and Dubious Diagnoses, and Find Your True Well-Being, which is available for pre-order now. Just go to christyharrison.com/thewellnesstrap to learn more and pre-order the book for its April 2023 release. That's christyharrison.com/thewellnesstrap. A big thanks, as always, to our editor and sound engineer, Mike Lalonde, community and content associate, Vinci Chui, and administrative assistant, Julianne Watasek, for helping me out with all the moving parts that go into producing this show. Our album art was photographed by Abby Moore Photography, and the logo was designed by Melissa Alam. Our theme song was written and performed by Carolyn Pennypacker Riggs, and I'm your host and producer, Christy Harrison. Thanks again for listening, and until next time, stay psyched.
In Indiana, summer means more than sunshine. It's hiking miles and miles of trails to magnificent views and cruising through caves on underground river rides. It's spending the night in a floating cabin and scuba diving into your next big adventure. It's riding a horse and buggy through historic towns and camping with elephants at a wildlife park. It's anything but ordinary. Plan your trip at inindiana.com/summer.